We have on the phone Patrick Coburn. We were going to talk about Bo Bergdahl, but events in Iraq have kind of taken over the situation with the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant having now captured Tikrit. Patrick Coburn, welcome back to Takes on the World. Thanks you could share your time.
Thank you.
We've heard this morning that this group of Sunni militants, jihadists, Islamic fundamentalists from who have been fighting in Iraq and in Syria have made major advances. They've captured Mosul now, Tikrit. What can you tell us about them?
Well, the Islamic State over Iraq and the Levant is an al-Qaeda-type organization. In fact, it used to be al-Qaeda, called al-Qaeda in Iraq, but it expanded in order to claim to fight in both Iraq and Syria. It had been fighting pretty effectively over the last year. This was an organization that people thought was on its last legs in 2010. But I think primarily because of the uprising in Syria by the Syrian Sunni in 2011, and because the Sunni Arabs in Iraq, who are about 20% of the population, felt marginalized and persecuted by the Shia government of Nouri al-Maliki, they've made a sort of astonishing comeback. They also are, though they're extremely ferocious, they are very sectarian. They kill and persecute and kill anybody who disagrees with them, Shia or Christians or anybody else. They're very well organized and militarily very effective. But even so, what's really astonishing this week is the ease with which they captured Mosul, the northern capital of Iraq. This is a city of 1.8 million people. It doesn't have a garrison of 60,000 men. It's doubtful if the attackers number more than 1,300 or maybe a couple of thousand at most. And it shows the completely dysfunctional nature of the Iraqi army. And I think it shows that the Sunni Arab population of Iraq, as I said, 20%, maybe 5 or 6 million people, if they don't support the Islamic State, they probably hate and fear the government even more. I don't think they like either of them. But the government, I think, is discredited among the Sunni. So this is like turning into a Sunni uprising.
Is this liable to lead to an extensive... I mean, we've had a kind of a low-level civil war going on there since the U.S. Pulled out its troops and after destroying the country, essentially destroying the country. Does this bode for a division of the country that people have talked about before, do you think?
Yeah, it's getting more and more sort of concrete, this division. I mean, you have three big communities in Iraq, 60% Shia, 20% or maybe a little less Kurds, and about the same for the Sunni Arabs. The Kurds were sort of had an independent enclave within Iraq in the north. Now it looks the Sunni are doing the same thing. But it's more than that. You know, it's really, people talk about sort of carving up Iraq as though it was easy. But, you know, what do you do about Baghdad? You know, there are Sunni enclaves city. You know, what do you do in there are other areas where, if not exactly mixed, but there are Sunni living beside Shia, you know, so it's not something where you can make a clean cut and say Sunni this way, Shia that way. But this is a sort of a major event. You know, it's one of these, what's happened is one of the events which, you know, like the U.S. invasion of 2003, like the uprising previously, which is going to, I think, reverberate over the next few years. It'll also affect the war in Syria because ISIS, the Islamic State, is also fighting there. And it will be vastly strengthened by what's happened in Iraq because it controls a large territory there. It has loads of weapons. It's captured. It has ammunition. It has money. So this will make it even more dominant in the Syrian opposition.
When we were going to speak about earlier, we were planning to speak about the release or trade of Bo Bergdahl for the five Taliban officials and what that says about the U.S. invasion of misadventure in Afghanistan. Perhaps you could kind of put these all in perspective and what the U.S. footprint has been on that side of the world starting back in 2001.
Well, yeah, I covered the invasion of Afghanistan and later of Iraq. I would say, you know, what's in common? Well, frankly, foreign occupation tends to be strongly resisted in most countries. It tends to immediately make things worse rather than better. People really don't like foreign soldiers in their streets. You know, now you hear people saying in Iraq that the U.S. should have stayed longer. I mean, the last troops withdrew at the end of 2011. But I don't think it would have made an enormous difference. A few American troops around. The most important things were the Sunni uprising in Syria, which encouraged the Iraqi Sunni to think that they could, which lost power in 2003 when Saddam fell, to feel that maybe they could rise again. The Shia government of Nouri al-Maliki made the Sunni feel, with every reason, that they were second-class citizens. The sectarian divisions grew. I think it shows what a sort of rickety structure the U.S. ended up by installing to replace Saddam Hussein.
It seems very much like now when Americans, officials look at both, let's say, Afghanistan, but particularly now Iraq, and that it's a problem that we had nothing to do with, that suddenly the Iraqis can't deal with the fact that they now have so-called a democratic government, free elections whatsoever, the appearance of that, free elections being kind of a joke. You've written about that recently. That there's somehow the United States that goes in, destroys the country, and then walks out, and then leaves a residue for years. Do you see the Sunni-Shia conflict spreading across, well, it spread across the region, but going on for a long, long time?
I do, yes, because it's, you know, it's at the heart of things in Iraq. It wasn't always like that way, but it was similarly in Syria. You know, you have a version of Islam, the Wahhabi version, which is which Saudi Arabia follows, and which is very fundamentalist, regards Shia as heretics, wants to impose a Sharia law, wants to have women as second-class citizens, if citizens at all. This is the official religion of Saudi Arabia. I think one of the main things that's changed in our era is the way that the Sunni Islam, Sunni Muslims, mainstream Sunni Muslims, how far this has been affected by the Wahhabi. So the whole lot has moved in a more extreme direction. So you get lots of, you know, even where there are small Shia minorities in Indonesia or Egypt, you have them being persecuted or lynched. And that affects, of course, Iraq and Syria as well.
And now we have, of course, the warnings in Europe that a number of Sunni Muslim immigrants who have immigrated to France and Britain have gone over to fight in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. And now we see the fear-mongering within the European circles about bringing the war home. How realistic is that?
Well, I think that's probably going to happen, but I think it's more serious than that, in that you have these al-Qaeda-type organizations in northern Syria and northern Iraq that now control an area greater than Great Britain. I mean, an area, you know, in American terms, I guess, about the size of Michigan. And this has never happened before. This is far more serious than anything which happened under bin Laden. And the the Europeans have contributed to its growth by they've supposedly supported the moderate opposition against Assad in Syria, but primarily their support has ended up weapons. I mean, they haven't. The U.S. and Britain haven't given weapons directly, but they're in alliance with people like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who have done that. And those weapons, you know, are probably have been used in Iraq. So I think that they've they have a large measure of responsibility for keeping stirring the pot in Syria, allowing the war to go on there, and maybe not realizing that by stirring things up in Syria, they were automatically destabilizing Iraq. But it was inevitable that if the uprising, or whatever you call it, the fighting in Syria went on, then this would ultimately spread to Iraq and reignite the war there.
You wrote about the elections, a comparison, the elections in Syria and Egypt, but it was quite extraordinary to see in pictures in Beirut or Lebanon particularly, of tens of thousands of appeared Syrian refugees lining up to vote for Assad. Is that a case of supporting the devil they know as opposed to the...
There's a bit of that. It's just a recognition of power. It's not exactly a democratic election because there's no real opposition. Quite a lot of these people, I think, felt that they might be persecuted if they didn't vote. They also, I think, wondered if they'd there were stories that they wouldn't be able to get back into Syria if they didn't vote. But also, I think that there's a feeling among a lot of Syrians, you know, that the government is bad and the opposition is even worse. So, you know, there's no doubt that it's not just the minorities, the Christians and the Alawites, who support the government in Damascus. You know, there's a much broader range of people who feel that, you know, an opposition led by fundamentalist Islamic militants would be worse than the present government, bad though that is.
Is there any prospect for ending the war in Syria in the near future?
It doesn't look like it. I mean, there's, you know, people are completely exhausted there. They're desperate for the war to end. But, you know, there are so many players in this war now that it's difficult to see how it would end. If there was an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, that would be enormously helpful. You know, one suggestion might even be that the so-called Free Syrian Army, which is a kind of minor player, but is meant to be the moderate opposition. Ford, the former American ambassador, has had a piece in an op-ed in the New York Times this morning calling for arming them. Now, actually, they're a pretty minor player. And this is unrealistic. But, you know, one thing that maybe could be done would be to get elements, at least, of the Free Syrian Army to ally themselves with Assad against the al-Qaeda-type movements. Otherwise, you know, they're going to grow in strength, you know, and we've seen in this week in Iraq just how strong they are.
Well, you've given me more than the 10 minutes you promised. I appreciate that. Any last comments about, any last observations about what's happening in the region for us?
I think it's getting more and more explosive. I think without the rest of the world appreciating it, certainly not the political leadership, the Iraq crisis, the Syrian crisis and the Iraq crisis have sort of bonded together and produced a much more explosive situation. I think that U.S. and British and European policy has been pretty well bankrupt ever since they discovered that Assad wasn't going to go down like Gaddafi. They've never really thought of a new policy. They'd climbed too far up the tree, declaring that Assad would go and should go to reverse that. So although they are saying they want peace, by demanding that Assad goes when he controls 39 of the 14 provincial capitals in Syria, they're basically saying the war should go on. But I think that, you know, what's happened in the last week might, I hope, would give them cause to pause and see that this crisis cannot be contained, is not being contained, and the longer it goes on, will destabilize the whole region.
Well, Patrick Coburn, thank you so much for sharing your time today. I look forward to your article about what's happening in Iraq in The Independent.
Thank you so much.
Take care.